Good day. Today is Monday, 29th September 2025. And as I did in my programme yesterday, I'm going to begin with a brief discussion of the elections in Moldova, where we now have a result. And as I rather anticipated, the result, perhaps unsurprisingly, was that Maria Sandu's party has emerged the winner. It has just managed to win more than 50% of the declared vote and retains a majority in the Moldovan parliament. Now, there's a number of points to make about this result. And first of all, the obvious one, at least the obvious one based on the returns in the election, which is that, again, the vote was won by Maria Sandu's party entirely as a result of votes from the Moldovan diaspora in the European Union. If voting had been limited to votes within Moldova itself, then the opposition, the combined opposition parties, would have got slightly more than Maria Sandu's party would have done and would have been the winner. Now, this is almost exactly the same as what happened last year in the referendum on whether or not Moldova should join the European Union and in the presidential election as well. In both of those elections, Maria Sandu basically won, with a wafer-thin majority, ultimately with the votes of the Moldovan diaspora in the EU making the difference. Now, taken by itself, that already points to a deeply polarised and divided society. One where one cannot speak of any strong consensus supporting either the current government or the opposition. Maria Sandu and her political forces appear to have strong support in Moldova's capital, Chisinau, presumably amongst middle-class voters there. But the opposition appears to be stronger in the more conservative countryside. Now, that's the first thing to say. And this, of course, is based simply on the declared results. But, of course, there is an awful lot more to say about this election than that. And, of course, I touched on all of this yesterday. Now, briefly, this entire election has been held against a backdrop of relentless messaging from Maria Sandu herself, from her supporters within Moldova, from the European Union, from Western governments, from the Western NGO community, from the Western media, about massive Russian interference in the Moldovan parliamentary elections. Why the Russians would want to interfere so much in these elections, never truly explained. By the way, I mentioned in my programme yesterday that Moldova is a poor country, poor through no fault of its own, in my opinion, but poor because of chronic mismanagement brought about as a result of the way in which it has, through no wish of its people, become a pawn in a gigantic geopolitical chess game between the Western powers and the Russians. That's the first thing. But it's a small country of 2.34 million people. 2,340,000 people. It's hardly in and of itself a place that is going to change the entire geopolitical situation. There is a lot of talk about its strategic importance, its geographical position. But as I often say, you could say this about practically every country. It has the bad luck to border Ukraine, where there is a political crisis, a long-standing political crisis, going back arguably to 2003, when the original Orange Revolution began to gain force, and which of course has erupted into all-out war over the last 3.5+ years. But that doesn't ultimately make Moldova important in deciding the outcome of that crisis. If Moldova were to take a pro-Russian position, for example, that would not affect the outcome of the war in Ukraine. I read reports in the Western media, claims in the Western media, that if Moldova went over to the Russian side, that would somehow prevent Western aid from reaching Ukraine. How? In what possible way? Most aid to Ukraine goes to Ukraine through Poland, and some of it, despite promises to the contrary, reaches Ukraine through the Black Sea. As far as I'm aware, none of the important military hardware, none of the economic assistance passes through Moldova, and nor do Ukraine's exports to the West. Just say. So I cannot for the life of me see in what possible sense a pro-Russian Moldova would be a threat to Ukraine. It's sometimes suggested that Moldova allied to Ukraine would somehow strengthen Ukraine's position with Russia. But that doesn't make any sense either, because under Maria Sandu's leadership, Moldova has already been, to all intents and purposes, allied to Ukraine. And as we have seen, it has made no difference, nor could it do, given Moldova's lack of size and lack of economic weight. So there is no sense, as far as I can see, that Moldova is a really strategic player. Of course, if the Russians battle their way to Odessa and take control of Odessa, that will bring them certainly a lot closer to Moldova. They could indeed be on the border of Moldova. But again, how does that ultimately change anything? I say this because, again, people spend so much time looking at maps, coming up with complex geopolitical theories based on what they see in the maps, that I think they lose sight very often of the actual underlying realities. Now, beyond this, what all of this does is, of course, it creates enormous problems for Moldova itself, because as the country finds itself basically a pawn in a geopolitical war which is not of its choosing, its political choices become massively circumscribed. Now, I say that, in my opinion, and it is my opinion, some may disagree, but in my opinion, Maria Sandu has been ultimately an entirely unsuccessful leader of Moldova. I cannot see how her government has made conditions better for the majority of the people there. The country remains extremely poor. It continues to be very divided. And the constant, feverish, anti-Russian rhetoric that she engages in, as we have seen, all it has done is deepen the polarization, the level of polarization, which already exists in the country. In any normal place where there were normal elections and politics were conducted in a normal way, she would have been voted out of power. And if this election had been conducted in a normal way, I suspect she would have been voted out of power. I in no way dispute the right of Moldovans who live in the EU to vote in elections in Moldova. I think they have an absolute right, if they are Ukrainian citizens, to participate in elections in their own home country. But what about Moldovans who live in Russia? Why are they being denied their right to vote in these elections? We're talking about 500,000 of them. I don't know that all of them oppose Maria Sandu. Just say, perhaps a majority do. If a majority of the people, the Moldovans in Russia, had voted, and if a majority amongst them had voted against Maria Sandu, chances are that she would not be prime minister. Her party would have lost the parliamentary election, and she would not have been elected president of the country in the presidential election. Just saying. It's not, of course, just the fact that the Moldovan diaspora in Russia has been, from what I can see, illegally deprived of its right to participate in elections in Moldova. Now, I'm not on the ground in Moldova, but I have been looking at some of the results. The results in Transnistria, which is sometimes incorrectly referred to as a breakaway region of Moldova, autonomous region of Moldova, it seems to me might be a more accurate way of describing it. Anyway, it looks as if, again, in Transnistria, it was either made very difficult or all but impossible to vote, or if people did vote there, their votes somehow or other simply weren't counted. The same appears to be true in another region of Moldova called Gagauzia, which apparently is also critical of Maria Sandu's pro-EU line. So if we put all of these places, Transnistria and Gagauzia and the Moldovan diaspora in Russia, we put all of their votes together, it's quite likely, in fact, it is very likely, that the opposition would have won the election by a significant margin and would now have the right to form a government. Now, that doesn't mean that the government that would have been formed as a result and in that way would have been perhaps a particularly good one. Moldovan politics have been scarred by corruption and electoral manipulation and oligarchical practices and all those sort of things. I remember some years ago, there was a parliamentary election in Moldova. It looked as if parties that nominally call themselves left-wing, the socialists and the communists in those days, they're hardly political forces in Moldova anymore. But anyway, it looked as if those parties had emerged with a majority. Only immediately after the election, I seem to remember 5 communist MPs defected and went over to the liberal opposition. And I have no doubt at all that they were bribed to do so. Just saying. Anyway, that's the kind of politics Moldova has had. And maybe a new government made up of opposition figures would not have been that different. But if Moldovans were able to control and shape their own politics, if they were able to hold their political leaders generally to account, if they were not part of this endless geopolitical chess game, if there had not been this situation where elections are conducted in this unhealthy, strange way, interfered with by preening outsiders, it's likely that sooner or later, perhaps sooner rather than later, Moldova would find its way and would finally get on top of its problems. What has happened instead is that we now have a deeply polarized country, a president who is rejected by a large number of people, doubts expressed about the election outcome, and it is not difficult to understand those doubts, and a sense also that the current Moldovan government ultimately is more concerned about pleasing its friends in Berlin and Brussels and Paris, and no doubt London as well, than it is in actually moving forward with genuine real change within Moldova itself, such as would benefit the people of that country. Now, yesterday I spoke at length about the disastrous practices of the European leadership in insisting on these outcomes in these elections. I said that this was, in my opinion, a reflection of the growing insecurity and lack of confidence of the European political class as it senses that its grip on the loyalties of its own electorates is slackening. And I don't take any of that back. But put that aside, ask yourself, what have they actually achieved? What, in real terms, have they actually achieved? They won in Moldova, and then what? And how is that going to change any of the important things in the world? And look what they have managed to do to Moldova itself in the meantime. Stranded with an unpopular president, unpopular with many people there, one who, as I have said, has failed to carry out any substantive constructive changes for the people of the country. A country that is, as I said previously, deeply polarized. A country which will continue to fail. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say about Moldova. I hope that I'm not going to have to discuss this country again anytime soon. I worry that if I do, it will be for all the wrong reasons, because things there are going bad, even more bad than they already are. But anyway, let's move on and let's discuss other things. Now, over the last 24 hours, General Kellogg, President Trump's envoy, has been busy speaking, and he's been talking again about Tomahawk missiles being supplied to Ukraine. He says that discussions to do this are underway. He said that the Ukrainians, I presume it is the Ukrainians, have come up with locations in Russia, targets in Russia which could be attacked. The Americans, according to Kellogg himself, are involved in those discussions. A very interesting admission, by the way. So the Americans are themselves discussing with the Ukrainians potential targets inside Russia to be attacked by Tomahawk missiles if they are indeed supplied to Ukraine. But Kellogg hastened to say that no final decision has been made and that it is all in the end up to Trump. And of course, all of that was said around the same time that the Vice President of the United States, J.D. Vance, had been making similar claims, similar assertions about Tomahawk missiles, and also said that the Russians were being obstructive with negotiations, that their military campaign in Ukraine supposedly is not going well, that they need to come to their senses and return to the negotiation table, and that if and when they eventually do, then the president, Donald Trump, will be prepared to act as a mediator, though it's clear that in that respect, we would be looking at something very much like the Kellogg freeze plan all over again. Now, here I would like to discuss a little bit more deeply the whole issue of Tomahawk missiles, because I've been doing some of my own research on this, and I've sought some advice about it. And this is very far from straightforward. That's the first thing to say. Now, when Tomahawk missiles were first designed in the 1970s, the United States created three versions. One was for ship launch, the other was for air launch, and the third was ground launched. And this was seen at that time very much as a strategic system. The ground launched Tomahawks, which were to be based in the Netherlands and in Britain, as I very well remember, were intended to carry nuclear warheads for long-range strikes against the Soviet leadership and other Soviet facilities in Moscow. So that was the original plan with the Tomahawk missile. Then, in 1987, the Soviet Union and the United States agreed the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. The land-based version of the Tomahawk was outlawed by that treaty, and as a result, it was scrapped. There are air-launched Tomahawk missiles, but these, again, are seen mostly as strategic weapons. They're carried, therefore, by strategic bombers. They are big. They have to be carried by bombers like the B-1, the B-2, presumably, and, of course, the B-52 bombers. I understand that they cannot be carried by smaller aircraft. And, of course, they're also carried by ships, by Aegis-class destroyers, by converted Ohio nuclear submarines, by various warships of the US Navy. There is not in existence, or at least there wasn't in existence until about a year ago, a ground-launched version. So that already causes problems, because despite the various demands that one sees to support Ukraine, it is hardly conceivable that the United States would lend to Ukraine strategic bombers. And of course, if it did lend strategic bombers to Ukraine and they were to be based on Ukrainian airfields, they would be impossible to conceal and the Russians would quickly destroy them. And if they were based in European air bases and were to launch missile strikes on targets inside Russia from those European bases, it would be impossible any longer to conceal direct Western involvement in the war, and the Russians would very likely retaliate by attacking those aircraft in those bases. I mean, so I don't myself believe that that option realistically exists. As for supplying the shipboard version to the Ukrainians, again, that obviously comes with the ships. And again, realistically, the Ukrainians are not going to be provided with Aegis-class destroyers or other warships of that kind. So, where does that leave this whole project? Well, last year, the United States did begin to introduce a new ground-based version of the Tomahawk missile. Now, after the United States quit the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty during Donald Trump's first term, it was no longer the ground-launched version of the Tomahawk missile was no longer banned. So the U.S., specifically the U.S. Army, felt itself free to begin development and design of a new ground-launched version of the Tomahawk. The trouble is that if we are talking about fixed launchers for what is actually a sizable system, these would be bulky and up to now, up till recently, they have been immobile and they would be relatively straightforward targets for the Russians if they were located in Ukraine. In fact, it's most unlikely that they would ever become operational because the Russians would attack them before they did. There is, however, a version of the Tomahawk that can be moved in a mobile complex. And this is where the Typhon system, which I have discussed in previous programs, comes in, because the Typhon is a road mobile complex which carries both can carry both air defense missiles of the sort that are operated by US Aegis class destroyers and potentially Tomahawk cruise missiles as well. The problem is that it only began to enter service last year and is, as so I understand, so far available in only very small quantities. I understand that fewer than a dozen have been built altogether, and this is a huge complex, difficult to conceal, probably not that mobile, by the way. I'm guessing that it would require metalled roads to operate along. But as I said, it's still a relatively new system. So it does exist. I understand that there have been discussions between the United States and Germany to sell some of these Typhon systems to Germany. And conceivably, and this is where we go back to the comments by Kellogg and Vance, conceivably, if these Typhon systems, which are not only bulky but probably very expensive, anyway, if they're sold to Germany, they could presumably be supplied to Ukraine. But we're talking about big, bulky systems. They can probably only carry a small number of missiles, and they would probably be relatively easy to track for the Russians, though one ought to say that we're talking about an enormous country, which is Ukraine, and it might be possible to conceal some of them there for a while. The point is that you would not have, it would be, I would guess, industrially and logistically impossible to have enough of these missiles, enough of these Typhon systems in Ukraine any time soon to make this project worthwhile. Because if you were to supply Ukraine with five or six of these systems, say, and they were to launch Tomahawk missiles against Russia, say, there could only realistically be a small number of these missiles launched by these systems in any one launch. I don't know how many systems, how many missiles each Typhon system could launch, but I am guessing not that many. Perhaps two or four or something like that. So let's say we were talking about five Typhon systems in Ukraine, and let's say they launched six missiles in total. That would be 30 missiles. And then you would have to get reloads, and that might take time. Now, Russia is not going to be brought down by 30 Tomahawk missiles. It's worth pointing out that since the Russians began their aerial offensive against Ukraine in October 2022, the Russians have been launching their own equivalent of the Tomahawk, the KH-101 missile, and by the way, the different but similar Kalibr 6 sea-launched missile against Ukraine, only they have been doing so in numbers that reach hundreds. Indeed, I believe that Russia has long since launched more of these missiles at Ukraine than the United States has Tomahawk missiles in its inventory. And Ukraine, though a very big country, is a far smaller country than Russia. And Russia, of course, has a much more advanced air defense system than Ukraine has. I cannot see, again, how this system, this missile, could make any fundamental difference. It's a little bit like the Taurus missile. It looks impressive, or at least the talk about it makes it appear impressive. Only in reality, when you unpack it, when you look at this carefully, you see very quickly that it is not. The same thing has happened with the F-16 fighter jet. When it was first talked about, people talked about it as a game changer. Only it turned out that it wasn't. In fact, it's been barely visible since it entered service. And, of course, with other systems as well. Before the Tomahawk missiles, the focus was on the ATACMS missiles. And the Biden administration is known to have eventually delivered up to 500 of these missiles to Ukraine. And they've all been launched at targets in Russia. Very few of them have got through, and those that have got through have done minimal damage. And I can't help but think it's the same with the Tomahawk missile. Obviously, supplying a missile system of this kind would be a huge act of escalation. It's impossible for Ukraine to operate a Tomahawk missile system without guidance and support from the United States. In fact, all pretense that that support and guidance and help was not being provided would disappear. We have already seen that Kellogg has been talking with the Ukrainians, has been talking about how the Americans have been discussing with the Ukrainians potential targets. The Tomahawk has the ability to launch nuclear warheads, and it is a strategic system, and the Russians would probably treat it as such. It would be an incredible act of escalation to take, an incredibly reckless and extremely dangerous thing to do. In order to do what? To launch a few more missiles at Russia over and above the hundreds of missiles that have already been launched at Russia and which have achieved nothing. There is no proportion here between the recklessness of this plan and its potential effectiveness. It's impossible to see how this could achieve anything good for Ukraine. It would certainly not change the dynamic of the war. If, as Zelensky says he wants, it is used for decapitation strikes against the Russian leadership, then it could very quickly and very rapidly lead us into all-out nuclear war, just saying. But if it is used for something less than that, say attacks on Russian oil refineries or that kind of thing, then ultimately it is not going to make any military difference. This proposal, what it demonstrates is the nihilism of Ukraine's advocates and their compulsive tendency to gamble without thinking through either the possible benefits, the potential benefits, or the potential costs. Because on any analysis, it's impossible to see any real benefits, but it is certainly possible to see the enormous potential costs. Now, let's just take a further step back. Because this system, the Typhon system, which is what would have to be delivered to Ukraine, is relatively new, and I suspect largely untested, it's unlikely to be available, as I've said, for Ukraine in any number until perhaps next year, late next year, maybe the year after. I wonder whether it will ever be delivered at all, because the logistical constraints, the industrial constraints, ultimately, are so great. The problems of deployment and supply are so great that it really just doesn't make any kind of sense to me. Of course, there could be a plan to deliver this system to Ukraine after the fighting has ended. There has been talk of things like that before, of supplying Ukraine with long-range missiles once the war has ended in order to deter the Russians. But one of the reasons why the Russians launched the special military operation was precisely because they did not want Ukraine to become a station ground for American long-range missiles that could reach Moscow. In fact, there was an exchange between Putin and Biden in which the Russians came away with the belief that Biden had promised them that there would not be any American long-range missiles stationed in Ukraine. That was subsequently walked back by Tony Blinken in a conversation he had with Lavrov, just saying. Given which, floating the possibility of supplying long-range missiles to Ukraine, cruise missiles like the Tomahawk and systems like the Typhon, is only going to convince the Russians that there is no point in negotiating at all, that the Americans are being completely insincere, and that it's better, therefore, to continue the special military operation and achieve regime change in Kiev, because any other outcome would mean that those long-range missiles, which the Russians don't want to see deployed in Ukraine, would be deployed by the United States in Ukraine. And these missiles are, of course, nuclear capable. Floating this idea of Tomahawk missile deliveries to Ukraine not only is not going to change the military balance in Ukraine, as I said, if the Russians have launched hundreds, perhaps thousands of KH-101s and Calibras, similar types of missiles, against Ukraine since the start of the special military operation, and that has not triggered the collapse of Ukraine. The launch of a very much smaller number of Tomahawk missiles against Russia, a vastly bigger country with a vastly bigger economy and industrial system and a vastly better air defense system, is certainly not going to change the dynamic of Ukraine. But floating this idea, floating the possibility of deploying these missiles, what it is going to do is make the Russians even more determined to see this war through to its end. It is like this disastrous mantra that is being endlessly repeated in Europe. Anatole Levin, by the way, has a good piece about this, again, which you can find on Unheard and in Responsible Statecraft. This disastrous mantra that the Russians should have no veto over Ukraine's membership of NATO, that Ukraine is, as Keir Starmer and other European officials insist, on an irreversible path towards NATO. That kind of rhetoric and these kind of plans, ultimately, all they do is prolong the war. Now, of course, there are many people in Europe, in Ukraine, and some in the United States who want precisely that outcome. They want the war to continue indefinitely, even if it means the ultimate defeat of Ukraine. Perhaps they don't believe that Ukraine will be defeated. They might imagine that Russia will implode, that President Putin will fall. Maybe they still cling to these comforting illusions. But though there are some people in the United States who talk about, who want to see the war continue, who talk about continuous war being better than what they define as a bad peace, that has not been the policy of the President of the United States, Donald Trump, or certain other senior officials of the administration. Or at least it has not been the publicly declared policy of these people. The Vice President, J.D. Vance, over the course of this interview, he again spoke about the president wanting a negotiated solution to the war. The US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has spoken about that also. Just saying that they want the war to end. Well, they're not going to get the war to end if they supply or even talk about supplying Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, either whilst the war is underway or after the war has ended. Now, maybe, as I know many people believe, the United States, despite what the president himself says and what his officials say, really has no real intention of ending the war at all. Maybe, you know, it's all smoke and mirrors, though I can't understand why, actually, why the United States would pretend it wants to wants the war to end, or the president wants the war to end, when he really wants to continue it. There are any number of compelling reasons, I would have thought, why, given that the war is being lost and American arsenals are being depleted and the American position in Europe is deteriorating, military position in Europe is deteriorating, and China is rising and all of those things, I can see any number of reasons why the United States perhaps would want to see the war end, or at least the wiser people in the United States would want to see the war end. But if that is the case, then those people need to understand that the Tomahawk cruise missile idea is going to entirely work against that policy and will reinforce the determination of the Russians to see this thing through. And that wouldn't matter if the Russians actually were losing, but of course they are in fact winning. And everybody who has followed the war closely can see that this is so. Now that brings me now to the military dynamics on the battlefield as they are currently playing out, because we've had further news of Russian advances. And again, I'm going to turn to the situation in Pokrovsk and in the area northeast of Pokrovsk, though both the Russians and the Ukrainians refer to this area, the area of the Russian breakthrough of August, as the Dobropilia direction, and seem to connect it more with the fighting around Dobropilia than the fighting in Pokrovsk itself. So let's start with that area first. There's been lots of rhetoric by the Ukrainians about successful counterattacks, about Russian soldiers there being trapped in cauldrons, though there is minimal film evidence to support this claim. I say minimal, perhaps more accurately, non-existent film evidence to support that claim. Events in Ukraine, rather, in fact, excellent blog altogether, Substack blog altogether, recently did a piece which showed that several Ukrainian commentators also don't believe the claims that the Ukrainians have indeed achieved great things in their counterattacks and have successfully trapped Russian troops in cauldrons in this area. But anyway, the Russians, for their part, contradict claims that this is, in fact, what has happened. And last night, yesterday, they claimed, the Russians claimed that they have recaptured the village of Nikaronova, the one village on the western side of this breakthrough area, which the Russians conceded that the Ukrainians had indeed captured. So according to the Russians, this breakthrough area, the Ukrainian counterattacks there have failed. The Russians are back on the attack. Radovka said 2 days ago that on the eastern side, in the area of the other village of Vladimirovka, it is the Russians who are now back on the attack. And according to the very latest reports, it is the Russians who have regained the initiative on the western side of this breakthrough area as well. I am not there. I don't know what the situation is. I have no information from the militaries on either side. But consistently up to now, ever since the first reports of the Russian breakthrough in this area in early August, I have found Russian reports consistently more accurate than the Ukrainian ones. When the Russians first spoke of their breakthrough in this area, I was deeply skeptical. I thought to myself that it was impossible that these claims could be true. I guess that there was some exaggeration. You can go back and look at my videos from early August. But it turned out that the Russians were indeed telling the truth, that they had indeed arrived, reached the village of Zaloty Kolodyaz, and that they had indeed captured the village of Kucherny Yar,
And well, ever since then, when the Russians have provided information, eventually it is corroborated, whereas Ukrainian information occasionally is, but far less often. So it seems to me, based on this and based on previous experience, that the Russians almost certainly do have the situation in hand. They brought the situation in this area of the breakthrough under control, and that they're in a much that they're probably in a much stronger position going forward, with the Ukrainians having wasted their strength in these counterattacks to launch further advances elsewhere. In the meantime, the Russians continue their advances in Pokrovsk, and there are reports that the Russians not only have advanced further inside Pokrovsk, but that they're starting to divide the Ukrainian groupings, to split them from each other, the better to deal with them piecemeal. Again, I am not in Pokrovsk. I don't know for a fact what is going on there, but it seems to me again that the trajectory of the battle is clear. Further east, we have Ukrainian reports which concede that the situation in Kupiansk is becoming impossible. And my own view is that the Ukrainians should have withdrawn from Kupiansk at least 2 weeks ago, and they're going to suffer heavy losses if they try to withdraw from Kupiansk now. But I would not be surprised if we see a sudden decision by the Ukrainians to flee from Kupiansk in the same way that they've done in the past, from Lysychansk, from Avdeyevka, from Ugledar, from Kurakhovo, from all of those places, multiplying the losses they're going to suffer as a result. Anyway, perhaps the most striking information, and perhaps the most fully verified information, comes from the eastern part of the Zaporozhye battle. The Russians have continued their remorseless advance in this area. The Ukrainian defences seem to be weak and disorganised, and given how critical and critically important the battle in this area is, the fact that the Ukrainians don't seem to be able to organise an effective defence begs many questions. But it looks as if the Russians, even as they prepare for a storming operation of the villages of Uspenivka and Poltavkova, are also launching a direct advance towards the main road, the main supply road to the southern town of Guliapolye. So anyway, the Russians continue to advance, and there are reports of further advances in other places too. I'm not going to provide a detailed update of what is going on right across the conflict line. The simple story is that the Russians continue their advances in every place. The Ukrainians last night conducted an attack on Belgorod, another drone attack. It did some damage, and I believe a number of civilians died, but this is a pinprick attack. Despite what you hear, the Ukrainian attacks on the Russian oil refineries are also pinprick attacks. I've been unable to find any evidence that these attacks have made any impact at all on overall Russian economic performance. They don't appear to be affecting the budget. There's been some gasoline shortages in Crimea, but elsewhere in the country, the problems with gasoline shortages, very common anyway during the summer months, had been apparently resolved. And, well, as I said, the war continues its grinding course. At some point in the next few weeks, before the end of the year, I suspect we're going to start to see places start to fall. Kupiansk, Siversk, where there's been more reports of still more Russian advances. Very much like what we saw last year when we saw Selidovo, Novogrodivka, Kurakhovo, Ugledar, all fall one after the other. We're going to see something very similar this year. Only the places are going to be more important. And at the end of it all, I suspect that we will see the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk conurbation essentially isolated with the Ukrainians there, basically simply clinging on. Well, that, it seems to me, is the story of the war. And as I said already, Tomahawk cruise missiles are not going to make any difference. What they are more likely to do is to make the Russians even more determined to press on. And in this, well, we've had confirmation from the president of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko. He has told the Ukrainians, look, you really are going to lose. If you don't come to terms now, you're going to lose your entire country. Until and unless, I suspect, the Americans themselves understand this, there is no chance of the Ukrainians acting upon warnings of that kind. And by the time the Americans understand it, by the time they realize that the collapse is there, I suspect it will be too late. Anyway, that's the battle in Ukraine. That is the overall military situation in Ukraine. President Putin is apparently going to make a big speech in a few days' time this week. No doubt he will touch on the situation in Ukraine. We will see whether and what plans and ideas he has. I doubt that there is going to be any major change in Russian policy, but it might be that he could make a final proposal to Ukraine. We'll just have to wait and see. But it's also possible, of course, that he could be talking about other things too. In the meantime, the war, the situation elsewhere in the world continues to be very precarious. No more so than in Europe, where, according to Politico, various European officials have been talking to each other about how to respond to the alleged or purported Russian encroachments on European airspace and whether to shoot down Russian aircraft or not. And the article in Politico says that there's no real agreement or consensus about what to do. Some are talking about a Franz Ferdinand moment. This is the event that took place in July 1914, when Gavrilo Princip, a member of the Black Hand group, assassinated the heir to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, generating a crisis which snowballed into the First World War. And there are apparently worries that if Russian aircraft are shot down in the sort of wild way that people have been demanding, that this could indeed precipitate a world war, or at least an uncontrolled spiral of crisis with the Russians. Well, of course, that is absolutely true,
But then, of course, that takes us back to the incredibly reckless rhetoric that we've been getting in Europe over the last 3.5 years, ever since the start of the special military operation, as I have discussed in programme after programme. The way to avoid that kind of crisis is by talking to the other side. And that, of course, is precisely what the Europeans refuse to do. So the result is that they now claim to be in the dark about Russian intentions. How can you know Russian intentions if you close your ears to what the Russians are saying and won't talk to them? But anyway, they refuse to talk to the Russians. They refuse to conduct diplomacy. They work themselves up into a state of hysteria. They refuse to consider the possibility that the drone incursions might have been an error, despite Russian offers to meet and talk about them. And Anatole Levin, who, unlike me, does think that these drone incursions and the Russian MiG-31 fighter jets were engaging in some kind of warning signal to the West, trying to make the Europeans understand that this European reassurance force in Western Ukraine that Starmer and Macron have been talking about is an absolutely unacceptable idea to the Russians. Anyway, he thinks that, as I said, that this was some kind of a warning. I personally doubt that. I think these are just minor incidents of a kind that happen on a regular basis. Some of them are contentious anyway. Perhaps all of them are. But, of course, the rhetoric has got completely out of control. And people are talking about Archduke Franz Ferdinand moment. This is what happens when panic and anger and hysteria take control. And of course, Zelensky is busy adding to this hysteria because he's now talking about how the drones, the Russian drones that are encroaching on the territories of Denmark and other Scandinavian countries, and of course we don't even know that they are Russian, that these drones are actually taking off from shadow fleet tankers and ships, that it's from these ships supposedly that these drones are encroaching Western territory. And Zelensky has also recently been saying that In the event that Ukraine is defeated, the Russians already have their next target in line. Anyway, if you listen to this kind of panic mongering, if you work yourself up into a state, then it's not surprising that you're going to end up thinking about Archduke Franz Ferdinand moments and stalking about the start of World War III and all of this. The contrast with the Russians here is again very striking. Dmitry Medvedev, vice chairman of the Russian Security Council, former president and prime minister, has issued a rather cool comment about all of this. He's discussed the prospects of the start of a war in Europe. He said that the Russians have no intentions or plans to start a war and no offensive, aggressive intentions at all. He also says that he doesn't believe that the Europeans ultimately will do so either. But he does say, and about this I have to say I agree with him, that given the fanaticism and lack of balance and frankly irrational and histrionic language that we're getting from some people in Europe, the possibility that things could go disastrously wrong, though low, cannot be excluded entirely. And I'm afraid about that he is right.
It's nonetheless interesting to contrast the measured attitude of the Russians to all of this hysteria and the agitation and anger and recriminations and blame games and the panic mongering and the fear that you see sweeping Europe. Now, I ought to quickly come back, and I'm going to do that as part of my last comments in this programme, to this issue of the Tomahawk missiles and why this whole topic of discussion has come up again. Well, of course, it originates with Zelensky, and Zelensky continues to demand massive sanctions against the Russians. He's still agitating for that. And when he talks about sanctions against the Russians, he means sanctions against Russia's trading partners as well. He has not given up on any of that at all and doesn't seem capable of doing so. But if one puts him aside, it is interesting that the Americans, for the moment at least, are not talking about sanctions in that way. And I'm going to suggest that the topic of the Tomahawks has now come into the open in the United States because the Trump administration has discovered over the last couple of weeks that which we on the Duran and I on this channel have been talking about for a very long time, which is that the West, the United States, the Europeans lack leverage. They constantly demand that the Russians do this or do that, that the Russians accept outcomes that the Russians have rejected, that the Russians go for ceasefires or freezes of the conflict, or that they accept European peacekeepers in Ukraine, or they agree to NATO membership one day for Ukraine, or something of that kind. Things which the Russians always and repeatedly say no to. And then the Americans and the Europeans discover that they have no way to pressure or force the Russians to accept those demands. So the West, the United States, has imposed any number of sanctions against the Russians since 2022, indeed since 2014. They have frozen the Russian central bank reserves. They've tried to cut off energy supplies from Russia to Europe, and this has been disastrous to Europe, and it has led to energy costs rising in the United States as well, by the way, just saying. They have provided huge quantities of weapons to Ukraine. They continue to finance Ukraine. They've been doing that now, well, basically since the Maidan coup of 2014, but they've escalated massively doing all of those same things since February 2022, when the special military operation began. And none of that has worked. And of course, over the last few months, since April, in fact, Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal, undoubtedly to some extent supported by the Europeans, have been pushing this idea of the United States imposing massive tariffs on countries that buy Russian oil and Russian gas, Russian energy products. And what the Americans have discovered is that the countries that do buy Russian oil and Russian energy products, India, China, Turkey, are not prepared to stop doing so, that they are not going to bow to American threats of massive tariffs. And the Chinese, of course, have gone much further. They have, over the last couple of weeks, gradually let all effect of Western sanctions, American sanctions on trade relations between China and Russia fall away. So they've agreed Paris-Siberia 2. They're pressing ahead with the Russians in nuclear cooperation. They are accepting MIR cards and payment systems. They provided the Russians with visa-free travel access. They're allowing Russian companies to float bonds in Chinese financial markets. They're buying liquefied natural gas from heavily sanctioned Russian LNG facilities, and their ships are now docking in Crimea. And one gets the sense that the Chinese, over the last couple of months, since Donald Trump began his tariff wars, have finally said to themselves, well, there's absolutely no point. We've been working round these sanctions up to now. We've tried to protect part of our economy from threats of secondary sanctions, but we see that the Americans are still coming after us, and in spite of everything we do, so we might as well just go ahead and move forward with this important, in fact critically important for us, relationship with the Russians, and they're building up their trade with the Russians in that way. And the other BRIC states are doing the same, and they're moving forward with their various payment systems and all of that. So sanctions are not working, and there is little prospect that they will. And the United States was very badly burnt back in April when it imposed 150% tariffs on Chinese trade, Chinese imports, and discovered that the Chinese could bring large parts of America's industrial and high-tech industries into crisis by withholding rare earths over which they have an effective monopoly. So this particular sanctions bluff has been called. The weapons supplies to Ukraine have failed. The tariffs against the Russians have failed. The attempts to destabilize the Russian financial system have failed. So there is no leverage. And this is something that some people in Washington find very difficult to accept. And this is why Kellogg, who has been talking about sanctions and increasing the sanctions, ramping up the sanctions, appears to have got together with Zelensky and said, well, look, if we cannot impose tariffs on Russia's trading partners, if we can't crank up the sanctions even further, if it might be actually rather risky to go after Russia's shadow fleet, which is in any event an amorphous operation which is difficult to get a handle on, well, let's try and get leverage some other way, and let's threaten the Russians by supplying long-range cruise missiles, Tomahawk missiles, to Ukraine, or at any rate threatening to do so. And let's do so notwithstanding Zelensky's talk about decapitation strikes on the Kremlin. Now, this isn't going to get the United States leverage either. It's not going to force the Russians to the negotiating table. As I said earlier in this program, what it is going to do is it is going to do the opposite. It is going to make the Russians even more determined to see this thing through. Now, this is the reality that people in the West are in denial about. They still believe that there is some magic lever or magic button that can be pressed somewhere or pulls somewhere that is going to turn the whole situation and is going to force the Russians to the negotiating table, or perhaps more accurately, get the Russians to capitulate to Western demands. It's not going to happen. Vice President Vance spoke very plaintively about how the Russians have refused bilateral contacts with the Ukrainians and have refused trilateral contacts
involving President Trump. What he's clearly referring to, even though he tried to fudge the question, is that Putin is refusing to meet Zelensky, except in Moscow, where Zelensky refuses to go. And Putin is not agreeing to a trilateral summit meeting with Zelensky, because Putin says that there's no point in having such a meeting unless the work has been done in advance and has been carefully prepared. You may agree with that, or you may not. You may think that Putin is being unfair in taking that stance. In my opinion, I think it is completely consistent with Russian approach to diplomacy and Russian national interests. The point is that Putin is taking that stance because he knows he can. Threatening the Russians, trying to coerce them in some way, either through threats of sanctions, more arms deliveries to Ukraine, confiscation of Russian assets, or Tomahawk missile deliveries, is going to fail. It is going to bring us closer to that point when, as Lukashenko says, Ukraine is lost. And of course, it does increase the real risk of a Franz Ferdinand moment. The only way forward in this conflict, if something is going to be retrieved, if the West is going to come away with something, is to engage the Russians in serious negotiations and accept that those must be on the basis of the Russian proposals, the ones that Putin outlined at the Russian Foreign Ministry on the 14th of June, 2024. In other words, Istanbul Plus. Until this fact is accepted, the crisis in Europe will continue. It will deepen. The economic problems in Europe will intensify. And the United States, the president himself, will find that the war goes on. And, well, he's now lost his chance, in my opinion, to walk away. His latest statement in his Truth Social post really doesn't come close to being sufficient to do that. He's lost his chance to walk away. And since he's tried to negotiate a deal, a compromise, the time has come for him and everyone else in Washington and in Europe to understand that there is only one deal on the table, and that is the one that Putin outlined more than a year ago on the 14th of June, 2024. I doubt that Trump is prepared to do that. Obviously, the Europeans are not. Zelensky never will. So in the meantime, we get these reckless plans about Tomahawk missiles and other things. And all that is doing is leading us remorselessly, step by step, closer to that outcome where, as Lukashenko puts it, there is no more Ukraine. Anyway, this is where I finish my programme today. Let me remind you all, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.